The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. Sponsored by Raiden Solicitors. Award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.
Hello and welcome to The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. I'm Lydia El-Khoury and today I'm really delighted to welcome back Karen Hannan, who is our resident SEND expert. Is that okay? Is that a good enough title?
Yeah, resident SEND neurodivergence kind of
guru.
Yes.
Brilliant.
Lived experience and learning, what can I say?
Yeah.
Broad approach. Yeah.
And that's what's awesome about talking to you, Karen, is you've got the knowledge, but you've also got the lived experience. So I love having you on and I love picking your brain. So it's been a while. Welcome back and thank you.
And Happy New Year. Not sure why we stopped saying that.
I think at this stage it might be pushing the limits. But listen, so I've got a lot of things I want to pick your brains about. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to neurodivergence, I suppose top of everybody's list of maybe complaints or concerns or issues are waiting lists. Mm-hmm. So can you talk to us about waiting lists, please?
Yes, I will. So there are very long waiting lists, whether you're an adult or a child, and you're kind of either thinking about or your parents are thinking about that diagnostic pathway or on that diagnostic pathway. So across the UK at the moment, the waiting times, depending on where you are in the country, can be between about 2 and 8 years long. So imagine if you're an 8-year-old child, you're going to be 16 if you're on one of the 8-year waiting lists, right? And so it's a difficult thing. And there's also at the moment some sort of pushback in a way or thinking around, do people or sort of triaging who goes on the waiting list? And so in some ways, limiting access to it for those people, adults or children, who are not necessarily neurodivergent enough, according to the onlooker or the person who's deciding who goes on the waiting list. And so often what I find with parents when I'm working with families who are seeking the diagnosis and thinking about that and who are keen to follow that pathway. So these would be parents who are interested in the diagnostic route for their child, that the waiting lists are so long that what do you do in the interim? So to start with, I would say that if you suspect or the school suspects or particularly if you're on the pathway itself, if you actually get on the waiting list, the suspicion is that this child or young person is likely to be autistic ADHD, for instance. And so the advice I give is to approach that through what I'd call a working model of supporting an autistic or ADHD child. And the crossover between the two is very high. And so I would always urge parents to familiarise themselves with what actually autism is. And there's a variety of organisations in Hertfordshire that can help with that. And then that way, through the resources and the training that's on offer, parents can begin to adopt approaches at home that are hopefully going to help them to be more successful in what it is they're trying to achieve within their family lives and to support their child. And also when interacting with services like education, etc. Often what I get is a question from parents where they suspect potentially there's autism or ADHD in the mix, and they're told they have to pick one pathway. So at the moment, there's not a joint pathway. Which one should I go for first? And my advice is usually there's no clinical benefit to an autism diagnosis. So there's no treatment for autism, rightfully so, because it's just a different way of experiencing the world. So there's no medicine you can take that's going to make life feel a bit easier. For autistic people in particular, it's much more about people around us changing their approaches towards us through the lens of understanding who we really are so that we can be our authentic selves. And that already begins a greater successful outcomes for the person. Okay. But for the ADHD, there is a clinical benefit to the diagnosis in that medication is available for ADHD to support areas like focus, impulse control, motivation, that kind of stuff, which can be quite difficult for ADHD people. And that can impact how easily they're able to manage the day-to-day requirements of living in the world, right? So an ADHD medication can help with that, but you can't get ADHD medication unless you have an ADHD diagnosis. There's no other way to get it. So that's always what I would say is I'd focus on the ADHD pathway. I would still adopt that working model until you get to the point of diagnosis and you get to the point where medication is available to you. But in terms of clinically, which route to go first, that would be always my advice. The other thing I found out the other day, which I was really staggered by, is that so in order to access an ADHD diagnosis, your first step is to go to your GP. That's the beginning of the referral pathway. And so what you would do is you visit your GP. My advice is always to get hold of what's called the DSM-5 or the ICD-12, which is basically the handbook for psychiatrists, psychologists. And it describes all kinds of mental health, you know, differences, different ways of being in there. And you'll find in there the clinical description of autism and the clinical description of ADHD. And what you can do when you're thinking about approaching the GP is to get the description, the medical description of autism, the medical description of ADHD, and sit and think about your child across their life stages, or if it's for you, think about your own lifespan, and map across the diagnostic criteria to things that you've experienced, things that are difficult, things that you're good at, you know, and sort of map it across. So when you go to see the GP, who may or may not be particularly skilled themselves in the nuances of neurodivergence, sort of ADHD and autism, that you are building your case for getting on the referral pathway. Okay, because at the moment, because of waiting lists, they're starting to limit it sometimes in some areas. So in order to get the diagnosis, you have to be on the pathway. And once you're on the pathway, the routes are you can either be seen through your local NHS ADHD assessment department or, you know, service area. But there's also within the NHS something called Right to Choose. And this covers various conditions under the, you know, as defined by the NHS as a condition. And one of them is ADHD. And this means that there are other providers, private providers that are contracted or have been commissioned by the NHS to offer ADHD assessments and therefore can do the assessment for you and, you know, then say it's ADHD or it's not ADHD. And on the basis of a successful diagnosis, they can begin to do the titration for adults. So if you're an adult, so if I think of myself, I went through Psychiatry UK. There's a list somewhere online of a variety of providers. You can just do your own research around that. And so I was diagnosed. I was then assigned over to their titration team. They titrated my medication. I made sure that before I went that route, I'd spoken to my GP and agreed with them that they would do what's called shared care, which means once the titration has been set and, you know, is working well through Psychiatry UK, the prescription side of it can move over to the GP. And so rather than having to always speak to Psychiatry UK, I just get a repeat prescription for my medication. And then Psychiatry UK review my meds once every 6 months or a year. So that's the agreement. But what I found out the other day through a social worker is for children, because children and young people can also be assessed in that way and can get a diagnosis, but they're not able to have the medication through that route. They have to go back to the waiting list for CAMS and go on that waiting list, even though they've got a successful diagnosis, to be able to get their medication. Because children and young people are a special case under ADHD, it has to be a young person's service, a child's service, that actually does the titration side of it, which I was really staggered by. That you've got these children and young people for whom, mostly for children and young people and parents of, you know, those children and young people, the sort of seeking or interest in diagnosis is not happening because that child's life is fantastic, right? It's usually happening on the back of a very difficult life experiences in the family, outside of the family, and how the child is coping, etc. So to have a system where you can fast track the diagnosis, but you still have to wait 3 to 8 years to get the medication that can actually support the difficulties that the child is facing in school, potentially, let's say, with, you know, focusing their attention, you know, being able to listen, not calling out, not interrupting people. You're still at, I was triggered. So I thought I would raise it with you because I can't say I know yet what the solution is. But I certainly think it's something that needs to be thought about.
And it's great to raise awareness for that, Karen. So basically, it slows the process down significantly and parents should be aware that it will. So the sooner you start the process, the better, particularly if you think medication is needed further down the line.
Yeah. And I think also I'd go back to particularly if you've actually got the diagnosis through that route, although you can't access the medication, what you can do is then use the diagnosis when you're interacting with schools or services, or you're looking for reasonable adjustments. For instance, let's say your child is going to be having a medical procedure and they've got particular sensory issues. You know, you can talk about the fact that under the Equalities Act, they're entitled to reasonable adjustments to the process in order to make it successful. And generally speaking, particularly in healthcare, I find they're usually very accommodating. And yeah, so I think that's one thing. I think the other thing is that sometimes people ask is, we come back to this thing, is it, you know, do we need a diagnosis? And it, number one, it depends on the person. Very often for adults, like let's say like myself, later diagnosed adults, very often for us, diagnosis is a really important thing because it answers an awful lot of questions about ourselves. It actually underpins a much healthier self-identity very often for people because it means that adults can stop being too much or too little of something. Those labels, you know, people often say, do you need another label? And I think, well, I'd rather have that label than too lazy or too intense or not empathetic enough or too honest. As if, I mean, what's too honest, number one?
Oh, listen, I'm totally on the same wavelength. I'm definitely missing a filter.
Yeah, but then or two. Like, what is it? Do people crave to be lied to?
Yeah, I mean, I can totally relate. I just, you know, sometimes when you're having a conversation, and I've told you, you know, I've done the QB test, so I'm, you know, very, very likely to be ADHD and also kind of came across this later in life, thanks to the joys of the menopause. Another one of the kind of pluses of the menopause. But I you know, sometimes when you're talking to somebody and they're kind of talking in rhymes a bit, for me, they're talking in rhymes. They're probably being really diplomatic or really subtle or really all these lovely qualities. But I'm just like, can you just tell me what you mean?
Yes, you know? Exactly. Yeah. Or get to the point, please. It's almost like the justifications. People feel like they before they tell you what they need you to do or where you need to go, what time it is, they have to go through this sort of several paragraphs of justifications for the information they're about to give you. It's a bit mind-blowing.
I can really relate. So that really important things to flag up. So waiting lists go for ADHD over autism if you're kind of battling between the two of them or kind of making a decision. ADHD diagnosis, prescriptions grant for parents, but for adults, but not for children, immeasurably slowed down. Mm-hmm. Any other things that you want to talk to us about the diagnosis?
Yes. So I think it's important to understand that certainly, and the autistic community is kind of leading or was leading this initially, but it's expanding to other neurodivergent communities now, that within those communities, it's perfectly acceptable to self-identify. So, for instance, you were talking yourself about the QB check for you. But even without the QB check, you might be around, you know, various ADHD, autistic people. You might have quite extended, you know, younger people in your family becoming more and more identified or diagnosed. And then when you're learning about their experiences of the world, realizing that's how you experience the world. So it's perfectly acceptable within communities around neurodivergence to self-identify. And the good news about that, sort of coming back to this idea of a working diagnosis, is that, so when we think about the Equalities Act and we think about school, or we think about children who are struggling in school in particular, and we're thinking about what is it that could be, what could work differently in school, what could be done differently in school that opens up access rather than continues to, you know, these things continue to present barriers for the child within the school. And I tend to use the word barriers rather than needs for people, because the fact of the matter is that autistic ways of being, ADHD ways of being, dyslexia ways of being, this is just a different way of experiencing the world and experiencing information in the world and the sensory experience of the world. And unfortunately, we're required very, very often to navigate systems and spaces and places and social environments that work really well for the kinds of people that actually came up with those sets of rules and ways of doing things. And so it works very, very well for many, many people. But for some people, what we've historically said is, oh, they have special needs. But the reality is that they have particular barriers put in front of them, and they're set up to fail more often. So for me, the reason I use the word barriers rather than needs is I feel like needs still implies there's a fault in the person. Whereas barriers is really talking about what it is. You know, it's literally like putting a roadblock in front of people to enter a classroom. You know, it's actually having those, taking the lights out of the ceiling and putting them on the child's face for some children. And it feels like burning. We wouldn't say the child has a need. We'd say we need to change the lights, right? So I think that language is important, as you know with me, Lydia. But yeah, I guess.
And that's, I think that's a really important distinction to make, Karen. Absolutely. And that's, we learn every time we talk to you about how to just nudge the vocabulary so that it is more inclusive and less kind of one group speaking about another group, and more about a group like feeling comfortable with how they're being described.
Mm. Well, one way of looking at it is really objectifying, isn't it? If you think, I remember I was training actually some social work students at the university about 2 weeks ago, and periodically you hear people say something like, when you're talking about saying that actually the right support is about adjusting the environment, it's about changing the status quo effectively, right? And then periodically somebody will say, but that's how things are, right? And I just said, well, if we'd stuck with that, 100 years ago, let's say, I'm not too good on the dates, right? History and me, we're not, you know, history names. But let's say 100 years ago, women wouldn't have the vote.
Yeah.
If people didn't challenge the status quo, you know, we'd still have enslaved populations in, you know, various parts of the world.
Yeah. And just because it is the way it is, it doesn't mean it has to stay the way it is forever.
Yeah. No. And yeah, exactly. So it's really important to understand the importance of challenging how people usually view things. Because if we think back, I was watching a program the other day on the television, and it was portraying, it was sort of reflecting on a child's experience in a psychiatrist's office as an autistic young girl who was non-speaking. So wasn't that she couldn't speak? She just wasn't able to speak. And the language in the room, like, honestly, it was, you know, when people say it's difficult now, it was terrible back then. There's things like, why won't she speak? Number one, well, it's not the child wouldn't speak. The child wasn't in a situation where the child felt able to speak, whether that was a sense of safety. For some people, it might be just that their mouths don't work well enough that they can't mouth words. That doesn't mean they don't have intelligent things going on in their minds that they want to share and communicate and connect with people about. And that, you know, sporadic catatonia, that was another one. Oh, she has sporadic catatonia. And it was like, well, no, she's just zoned out because the environment is so traumatizing to her. And then the next thing was, we think she should be in an institution because she'll never be able to manage real life. And also, he called it childhood schizophrenia, which is what autism was originally called. So my point is not to freak people out, really, but yeah, but to say language matters.
Yeah.
And it's through different language, different ways of thinking, changing and challenging how people think about things and say things that we get to the point where we are now, which as hard as it is for some people in terms of being neurodivergent in the world, it's still much better than it was. And it's through that challenge, through that continuing education, through listening to autistic ADHD voices rather than people who aren't from within that community talking about us, saying they're researchers of people like us, and then misrepresenting our reality in a sort of fearful way, that creates such difficulties for both adults or individuals themselves, young people who are autistic, ADHD, dyslexic, but also for their family members, because we still have this fearful undertone with which we talk about the notion of being neurodivergent.
Yeah, brilliant, Karen. And you remind us again, you know, for parents who mightn't have caught your other interviews, explain to us why you feel that neurodivergent is the best way to describe. We've got about 3 minutes.
Yeah. I think that, so basically being autistic, and it is a way of being, it is not a faulty way of being. It's a different way. So, you know, the clue is in the word neuro, isn't it? Which is anything to do with the nervous system and the brain. The fact of the matter is that for whatever reason, our neurology differs to the majority of people's neurology. And we are a substantial enough group that we add up to a lot of people. So we have a name all of our own, which is neurodivergence. Okay. So we're the people in the greater population who experience the world differently. And for an awful long time, we've been objectified as, you know, faulty or broken or whatever. And this is at the root often of a person's difficulty with their own mental health, because it's that stigma that becomes internalized, a self-stigma. So for me, it's just a different way of experiencing the world. And it relates to how we process information, that is information that we receive, and also the way we, you know, ways that for us work better or less well in terms of expressing. So in our world, for instance, very often people like information expressed to them in writing, let's say. But for somebody like me, I mean, my mind is chaos enough as it is, trying to organize my thinking. This is great for me, right? Because you ask me a question, my brain goes, oh, yeah, I'll pull that bit out. But you ask me to write something down, it just takes me hours to do it because I can't organize my thinking in the same way. It might be how we communicate and socialize looks different. It might be our sensory experience. And for some people, that things like the sensory experience can be particularly difficult. So it's not that, I'm not saying that being within that neurodivergent community is a breeze. There are elements of being neurodivergent that can feel extremely difficult sometimes. But it's an amazing community. I often think about things like fire, the wheel, the internet, antibiotics, you know, computers. Very often I find people in the medical professionals, quite often neurodivergent. You know, we've changed the world over time in spectacular ways because we focus in on what could be done differently in a better way. And yet, because we don't always socialize in an expected way or show our empathy in a way that others expect, there's this notion that being neurodivergent is something to be fearful of. And my approach is, I mean, I would not want to be, I wouldn't, I you know, if someone said, let's take away the neurodivergence, I mean, that they'd be up for a fight, really. I just No, thank you.
You will hang on with both hands.
Yeah, it'd be like saying, let's take away your womanhood. It's part of who I am. Yeah. So, yeah.
I can totally understand that. I think the only challenge is understanding how your brain is different. Because obviously everybody thinks the way their brain functions is the way everybody's brain functions. Yeah. But it doesn't. And it's very hard to unpick that, isn't it?
It is.
And when you're talking about how you process different things, I'm just thinking, and me, I do. And that, like, I can relate to some bits and then not to others as well. So it's lovely to get the opportunity to come to compare brains. Mm. But in fairness, it's not something we do very often, is it?
No. But I think nuance is really important. And I think that when you look at that diagnostic criteria in those manuals, they miss a lot of the nuance. And this is part of the underdiagnosis. It's only really because autistic people are starting to pull apart the diagnostic criteria and saying that we all have more or less of these things, but that doesn't mean we're not autistic or we're not. But also there's something about, isn't there? Like, imagine if in terms of, you know, part of your identity, let's just say, you know, if let's just take strip gender back right down to male or female, right? Imagine if you wanted to be, if you identified as being female, you wanted that, you had to go and see a psychiatrist who was a man that had come up with a set of criteria about what it is to be a woman, and they got to decide whether you're a woman or not. It's just that ridiculous. Do you know what I mean?
I do.
Yeah.
Indeed. But it's lovely to talk to you.
And
as always. And lovely to hear, you know, you advocate for the absolute positives of neurodivergent people.
We're amazing people. Yeah.
Absolutely. So I'd love to have you back as soon as you can, because I want to pick your brain about positive behavior support approaches. Yeah. So, but we'll save that for our next chat.
Yeah.
But Karen, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much for having me. It's always lovely to see you and speak to people.
You too. You too. Thanks for helping our parents.
Oh.
We'll take a quick break now on the Parents Show on Mix 92.6.
The Parents Show on Mix 92.6, sponsored by Raiden Solicitors, award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.
Hi, and welcome to The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. My name is Becky Bowen. Grab yourself a cuppa. Tonight we're going to be talking to Ruby from Wooka.
Hello.
Hi, Ruby. Welcome, welcome. So first of all, let's find out who Ruby is. I'd love to hear a little bit about your story and how Wooka came to play.
Cool. Actually, you know, I started the business in St. Albans, so I'm quite local to it and I know quite a lot of it. So pretty much you can say like Ruby started in Wooka in St. Albans mainly for a sustainable reason. I grew up in Nepal, moved to here in the UK when I was 20 years old. So that's 16 years ago now. Growing up, childhood was fantastic. I did everything outdoors, climbing trees, you know, running after, chasing things. Didn't have any toys to play with, so pretty much made all the toys and played. So I had a really great childhood. But it was, I think, when I was 12, when I had my first period, actually so many things in my life changed. And I became from like tomboy to like this girl who would not go and do anything. Mm. And it was a horrible thing to go through, I think. So like as a child, whenever somebody used to ask me like, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I used to always say like, I want to beat the boys, you know, like that's very much like my like energy was there. And then first period, mum gave me her old sari cut into small pieces and told me that they are my period product and told me that I can't stay at my home because I can't be seen by my father.
Oh, wow.
And periods in Nepal is quite notorious and people are often seen as dirty. There is a typical word for a period called natune, which literally translates to untouchable, and that's what you are. So for 5 days, you can't go to kitchen, pour yourself water, you know, you can't go to your wedding, funerals, nothing. So that was, I think, almost like heartbreaking moment for me as a girl growing up.
Gosh, yeah, that's something that I suppose we don't really appreciate every day here. It's just accepted as part of life. I know growing up for me, we would see the Lilettes adverts or the tampon adverts and you were expected to still go roller skating and swimming and doing all of those things. So yeah, let's talk about Wooka then. So what you're here to talk about today, we want to share about Wooka and how amazing it is. I've personally used it. My daughter uses Wooka. For me, it was life-changing. So tell us a little bit more about Wooka.
Yeah, so I graduated from here doing environmental science. And my first year, and I was working this in St. Albans, and I started going to different school. And at that time, I was talking about sustainability and mostly on food waste. Got a big project with Sainsbury's, But that led me introduction to the schools here in St. Albans. And then the school started asking me, like, oh, can you run another sustainable project as well? And one of them was reusable period product, because school still don't talk much about reusable. They have pads and tampons and pretty much their period education stops there.
Oh, God, I remember being at school and learning about sex education and the school nurse coming in and getting a Lillette and putting it in a glass of water and getting so excited about how much it expanded. And that is literally the only thing I can remember about sex education, like learning about periods at school.
And then that's like a 30-minute education that you get, right?
Yeah.
And when I went to do this session, I talked about sustainability and reusable product because that's what I grew up using. But what the girls wanted was like something... Nothing from the Etsy or like handmade kind of thing. They wanted something beautiful looking and beautiful packaging and stuff. So on my way back home, I actually thought about, okay, what can we make so that the girls actually like it aesthetically, at least beautiful looking. So I ended up getting a secondhand sewing machine on that same day.
Oh wow,
£75, best pounds spent. And basically went to YouTube and put on YouTube and learn how to sew. And when you cut your regular underwear on the sides, it actually opens up to become a pattern. And when you have two of those underwear, you can put any fabric in between and restitch it and make it into a period underwear.
That's genius.
Yeah. So I thought like, oh, wow, this is great. So got all my old underwear, turned every pair of underwear into a period underwear, and I used it myself. And pretty much that was the beginning of it. For 6 months, I used it myself. Obviously, there were so many things wrong with that underwear that I made. There was no leak-proof layer. So later on, I started doing a little bit of research and found out that actually umbrella fabric or your reusable nappies fabric actually can be used as a leak-proof barrier into the underwear. And then made a second iteration and continued that. And I think this was 2017. One day, I thought, okay, I'll make a film and I'll put it up on Kickstarter. Because at that time, I did not have a job. So for me, it was like, okay... You know, if people like it, you know, this might be a good project to work on it. And 3 weeks in, we got £7,000 funding and Wooka was born. You know, like literally, I did not think about business or starting this project at all, other than like one step ahead, one step forward, those kind of moments.
So when was that, 2017?
2017, yeah.
And wow, you've just grown so much, so incredibly in that time. And the products themselves are beautiful. I can say personally that the underwear is so comfortable. Like quite often when you have your periods, they're a bit, you kind of obviously get a bit bloated and things can get a bit diggy. But you've got this amazing expansion on them that kind of like they fit from one size to the next. Me and my daughter could, who's tiny, who's 15, could literally wear the same pair of pants. It's amazing.
Yeah.
And the leaks... as well, like there's no leaks or anything. The products themselves are incredible, I have to say. Obviously, I've used other period pants as well, and actually, I'm not bleeding anymore because I'm in menopause. So for me, it's quite sad, really. I wish that these were around when I was growing up. We used to have, when you used to have matron at school. I don't know if you would know, but remember that.
Like the nurses.
Yeah. If you came on your period and you didn't have any sanitary products, we used to call them ducktails because the sanitary towels were so... big. You used to waddle when you were wearing them, so you always hated coming on your period when you was at school. But I mean, just the geniusness of it, that how long they last for is
incredible. And you know, like we were the first brand to launch period underwear in the UK, so pretty much this whole 8 years have been just about education, educating people that hey, look, you can use reusable product and it's absolutely fine, and you can put it in the washing machine and it absolutely is fine. You know, like you can wear it up to 8 hours. So very much the journey has been all about education. And, you know, I started Wooka as a sustainable brand, but soon we found out that there's so many hidden stigma here in the UK as well. You know, like I think there's like 1 in 2 girls drop out of sports because they start their period. Right. So last year when this whole stats came out, we thought like, we got to do something. So we started this campaigning, this program called Tackle Anything, where we have got now 3,400 girls that we support with period education, with free period underwear.
That's amazing.
So that they don't miss out on sports. They don't go, they don't say like, oh, I can't do a match, you know, or I can't go for a swim. So I think it almost has become this women's health, girls' health platform, rather than just sticking to sustainability. Sustainability is great, but I think more people are really concerned about their own health. And
yeah, being able to do more sports.
Yeah.
I know for me, the thing that blew my mind a little bit was swimming.
Yes.
Because obviously you'd normally have to rely on tampons to be able to go swimming, but actually they don't anymore.
No. And if you're looking at the marginalized community, if you're looking at the BIM community, myself, you know, I never learned to swim. I learned to swim when I was 24, 25 years old when I moved here. Mm. And that is still the case. If you're looking at Asian and Black community kind of way, they are often falling behind on swim classes. They are also often the person who don't use internal product. So if you don't have the right product, they might not even able to go to swimming classes and stuff. So The swim has been like incredible. Like in summer, a third of our sales actually comes from swim. Like it's become such a huge part.
Yeah, they must be. And I think the lack of knowledge around that as well, because there's still that fear. I love an ice bath. So I know when I was doing the ice bath, I was like, oh, I can't do my ice bath today. But actually being able to kind of do that. But I must admit, when I first used period underwear, the thought for me was, is it going to leak? Am I going to get out? And then am I going to be really embarrassed?
Yeah.
And there's not any of that.
Yeah. It's somehow the magic works, isn't it? It's the physics working, but we feel like it's a magic working.
Yeah, definitely.
One of the things that we really put a lot of effort is on the starter kit, because what we found out that parents are actually, they think that their daughters are going to get the period similar age that they started.
Mm.
But it's been like 3 decades between your daughter and you getting your first period, right? So many things have changed. Environment has changed. The food that we eat have changed. So at the moment, our main focus as a business is like, how can we prepare parents as well as teens to have the best start to period so that there's no fear whatsoever starting.
I think that's the most important thing. So what can we tell our listeners? So obviously we've got quite a broad range of ages. So for the ones that haven't started their periods yet, how can we have these conversations so that they're not frightened of having their periods or starting their periods? What can we do for them?
Firstly, start with the reading a book together. Mm-hmm. That's always my favorite thing, is like we have got this 2 books, one for neurodivergent, one for neurotypical. And the book actually talks about changing bodies, moods, friendship, and then just starting the period and how it looks like and what are the different products to use, those kind of things. Just baseline understanding of like, okay, these are the changes that might come in next few years.
Mm.
That is a beautiful start. And then slowly introduction, especially for neurodivergent girls, what I would say is start using period underwear before they start period, because then they get more adoption rate becomes much higher in terms of ease of use for them, rather than giving them surprise completely a new product.
Yeah, definitely. I know I had lots of conversations around what to expect, what it was like, so to remove the fear. Lots of amazing books out there, so many. And actually, we're only really looking personally as a family at the neurodivergent route now. I would have even given that a thought or a consideration. I was really lucky to meet you at a mother-daughter retreat that I went to. And this is how we came to meet each other and learning about your products and feeling the products there. It was just, it was mind-opening to be able to experience that. And you've got lots of lovely products that we could talk all day about. And so what else can we do? What else is there that we can share with our parents, even for the older children as well, that might not necessarily be quite so aware about it?
Yeah. So a couple of things. If you wanted to be part of the WUKA family, we actually have started this new program called WUKA Talks, like the fire talks. We want to come to the school and teach young girls, and especially like teachers, students, parents, students, but also like it could be in different kind of settings, whether it's home education or whether it's an education. There, that is one place I would say is like, if you are anybody listening from your school, your head teacher, PTA, anything, please look up WUKA Talks on our website and you can book a free session on us. So one of the educator will come to your school, run a session, and the session is about changing bodies, body parts, hormones. Nobody has ever talked about hormones in school. We gotta talk about it.
So prominent.
Yeah.
Definitely. I mean, the hormone thing, again, it's something that with especially neurodiversity is something that can absolutely accelerate that. I know from my own personal journey, I probably got to menopause and then all of a sudden it's like the mask fell off and the hormones, and we realised that. And I know that happens a lot for teenage girls, is they're masking and they're covering up, and all of a sudden this hormone thing happens in their bodies and all of a sudden everything changes. Yeah. So to have somebody come and talk in a lot more specialist experience, I think is an amazing thing. Teachers are so pushed to the limit anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
To have somebody that literally just focuses on that.
In honesty, all speaking, teachers are not educated about periods in depth. You know, they are there to teach math, science and other activities and stuff. And I think sometimes you if you get the specialist come in, just take that, bite the hand off for that. So that's one thing that anybody listening to this can do, is like, if you are parents of any school and would like to book a Wooka Talk session, please do that. Yeah. Other thing is like, just be prepared, be in the realm. If you are parents of like young girls, you know, I would just say like, just be mindful that not all girls are same and equal, and they start their periods same and then their emotions are same. So it's just like, I think there's so much, I think, relationship wise we can do to start creating that bond between parents. And I have been, you know, the mother-daughter session that we were together absolutely touched me so like deeply. Like, I wish I had this when I was growing up, you know. And yeah, all I would say is like, check us on our website, you know, like more about what we do. We have got tons of blogs. We write on a daily basis. We do webinars. We do all, like, so yeah, you can come and check out.
I think that's the key, isn't it? Is talking about it and the knowledge and the awareness, and, you know, not going back to the days where it was something that was so taboo and something that we didn't share about. And there was a shame around it and embarrassing and all of the things. But I think a lot more people are a lot more open about it.
Oh,
I think that's thanks to people like yourselves having these open conversations.
This moment exactly happened, right? Like 7-8 years ago, I did my first session in Oakland's college, like showcasing the example of the underwear. This is what we are doing, kind of way. Every person that I handed the leaflet to actually dropped the leaflet in front of me. Like, the girls were like quite embarrassed and ashamed about it.
It's crazy.
And 6 months ago, one of the parents actually wrote me an email and said that they were driving with her daughter and her friends to a football game. And then they've found our advertisement on the toilet in the motorway service station.
I've seen it there too.
Yeah. And then her daughter came out screaming. She goes like that, like as if something happened. And then she turned to her mom and to her friends and said like, there's Wooka advertised in the back of the toilet and I use them. And then she went on and on for half an hour talking about how amazing this period underwear is.
That
right?
Must really light you up as well.
Yeah. 8 years, you know, such a great difference to see. I think generation wise as well, we are seeing much more girls are confident to talk about it than when we were.
Yeah.
You know, when we started our period. So I hope like the next generation will be completely different and open. And
I think I think, I mean, I've got a 10-year-old and a 13-year-old boy as well. So obviously the conversations are quite open in our house, and just having that experience. And I think the hormones is a big thing as well. My only wish is that you could make some normal non-period knickers so that we could wear
everybody could try it.
So let me just kind of ask you then, if there was one thing that you would love young parents and young people to know listening tonight that you could really take away from this conversation, what would that be?
Oh, that's interesting. I would say start the conversation early as possible. Mm. Be prepared. I think there's nothing worse than, and then I have met many parents who have waited till the end and they're there to start their period and then they don't tell you about it and hide for months and months. And I think as a parent, you might feel like quite deflected that you did not have that conversation. So I would say like avoid those kind of scenarios.
Mm. Do you know what? Actually, as you say that, it reminds me of having those conversations and my daughter actually genuinely being quite excited about starting her period because we'd had so many conversations about it. It wasn't something to be frightened of. It was something to genuinely embrace and understand. And once we've got that understanding of it, and as I say, there's so many amazing books and so many amazing things that we can do out there. And, you know, kind of you touched upon the mother-daughter days. If you can have that experience and share those, it really does create something incredible. So yeah, definitely look up about the talks and stuff as well, because that sounds awesome. So yeah, so.
And shout out to Girl Rising Movement. Honestly, if you don't know about it, you should book a session. If you are mother of a daughter, and your daughter could be a 7, 8 year old as well. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be like they have to become younger puberty. Yeah, exactly. It's such a better conversation to have as well. So.
So tell us, what does WUKA stand for?
WUKA stands for Wake Up Kick Ass.
It certainly does.
We are all about making period positive. So from conversation to the first experience to the last experience, you know, like we want it to be something to be proud of. Periods are the fundamental reason why human beings exist.
Absolutely.
So celebrating it.
And most women will experience it at some point. And most men, because if you're around a woman, then absolutely you will be doing that. Thank you so much, Ruby.
Thank you, Becky.
I really appreciate you coming to talk to us today. Where can we find out more about you?
You can find us. Actually, you can buy us now in Tesco and Boots as well. Or online at wuka.co.uk. And you can come and say hello to us at WukaWare on all social media.
Amazing. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us. And thank you so much for listening.
Thanks for having me.
The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. Sponsored by Raiden Solicitors. Award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.